I'll tell you something I love about being in France, in addition to some seriously delicious butter, and that is the wide selection of wines I can find in France for low prices. It can be much more difficult to source those same bottles back in the States, and that's why I love to buy wines out of France with Ideal Wine. I have bottles shipped to me, hassle-free. It's easy. Ideal Wine has a new auction every week and is a great source for iconic names like Ouette, Louis Roeder, and Domaine Lefleuve, as well as rising stars like Arnaud Lachaud, Gonon, and Tissot. Find the wines you'd rather be drinking at idealwine.com. That's IDEALWINE.com and have the wine shipped to you in the States. Use the promo code FIRST, FIRST, for $15 off your first order of $150 or more. Hey, that's $15 you could save, and that is some good butter money. See for yourself at Ideal Wine. I'm Levy Dalton, and this is All Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the wine business. Tommy Vanek of Verity Wines on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you, too. Thanks for having me here.
So you have a long career in New York wine sales, but how did we get there? I mean, how did you end up in the wine business? Was it something you always knew you wanted to do?
Yeah, I was born and I said, wait a second, I want to be a wine salesman. No, it was actually completely random. I had no idea I wanted to do this. It was never even my thought. Actually, when my parents would tell me, I'm not much of a talker, really. You might refute that. I didn't speak for 2 years.
When you were a little kid?
When I was a little kid.
Not recently.
Not recently.
When you were 35, between 35 and 37, you didn't say anything. No, as a little kid, you didn't talk much.
I didn't. My parents tell me I didn't speak to my kindergarten teacher until when school starts in September. I didn't speak to her till April.
Hopefully they were grading on a curve with the other kid that was still sucking his thumb. You know what I mean?
Exactly. So no, I found myself just kind of falling into the wine side of it more from just needing to get out of the restaurant side and recreating myself. I was in Miami for about 3-4 years.
What were you doing down there?
Toiling in restaurants. Probably half restaurants, half doing whatever you do in Miami.
The opening, double, closing shift.
Oh, 6:30 in the morning getting home, you know, in one of the nightclubs. And, you know, just progress through everything. I mean, probably in the 3 years, I probably had about 5 or 6 jobs down there.
Well, that's Miami style, though.
But that's...
that doesn't say anything about you.
But I always showed up for work on time. Actually, I worked tirelessly at times as well. But when I got down there, you know, I was in Colorado first. Just wanted to get out of New York.
That's a big difference just in terms of temperature.
In terms of temperature, absolutely. And I didn't want to leave Colorado, actually. I was dragged out of there. By a girlfriend.
Was that a girlfriend move?
Oh, of course. Isn't it always?
She's like, I'm a little cold. Again.
Again. Yeah. It's like, I'm miserable. I hate this. I'm going to Miami. You following? It's like, okay. I guess. I never any inclination getting down there.
So you get to Miami. You're working in a restaurant scene. Who else was down there at that time?
Believe it or not, a couple guys that are in the business up here now and are pretty successful one of them was actually my manager at the time. Paolo Domenighetti from Domain Select.
Oh, really?
He was my manager.
One of the
down
principals
there.
Of Domain Select was your
he
bar
was
manager?
He was a manager at one of the restaurants I worked at. Funny story. He probably doesn't mind if I say this. Because of me, he got punched in the face once.
Really?
He got into a fight with one of the servers. And I was holding Paolo back from going after him. While I was holding him, no one was holding the other guy.
Got sucker punched?
Got sucker punched. It's like, I felt so bad, my God.
Does he still hold that against you? I notice you're not working for Domain Select these days.
No. When we run into each other, we get along great.
He probably owes you one, though, right?
He probably does.
So you're down there in Miami, and
and you're working the hard shift at the restaurant, and what inspired you to get on the other side of the business?
Well, you know, when I got down there, it's before that I was pretty much just bartending waiting tables. As I was getting down there, as I was working down there, working with, you know, meeting friends, got more into the management side, started with bar manager at the Pelican on Ocean Drive, and then over into a couple of jobs later, actually, Moe's Cantina, which was a big cantina down on Collins Street, and got into more of the beverage manager side of the
thing. So that's the South Beach thing.
That's the South. Moe's Cantina was, it was a monster. I mean, it was a huge Mexican cantina right on, what was it, Collins and 7th.
And what year was this?
This was, I'm going to give away my age. This was 95.
And Scarface had kind of set the tone for Miami. And
Scarface,
down there,
Versace and was shot.
The Blue Door had opened up. And
when I got down there, there was nothing down there.
Is that true? Was it still a place where people are a little bit like wary to go?
It absolutely, south of Fifth Street, and there was one restaurant. You still had the old retirees sitting on their porches, the old people sitting there, and I haven't been down there. I haven't been back there in about 12 years, but I think when I was down there, probably in about 97, was the first chain store to actually move down. It was probably like a Gap. Before that, there was nothing, and so. You know, I was working this Mexican cantina, Moe's Cantina. It was a monster. It was so incredibly, incredibly busy. I had to order salsa from Southern, 25, 30 cases a week.
Really?
Yeah. That's just one item. Just
some serious
one
volume.
Item.
They're like, Tommy V's on the phone. Get the big truck.
Exactly, exactly. If I have to listen to the Macarena one more time.
Right.
I will.
Still scarred?
I will absolutely shoot myself. But knowing that I was just getting burnt out on the restaurant side, I was going to the restaurant. I was there at 12 o'clock, you know, doing whatever beverage director does during the day. And then bartending at night, and then closing up, you know, start at 12, get out at 2 o'clock. That wasn't the 6:30 one. That was the 2 o'clock one. And, but, you know, through that whole time, I started dealing more with the wholesalers. And down there was Southern for the most part. It was National.
Because there's not that many wholesalers.
There wasn't that many, and we were in a wine place.
Right, so you're not even really dealing with OPG. It's like
no, we weren't a wine. I think we had six wines, six red, six white, and we probably sold about six red, six white per week.
right. You're like, oh wait, we do have some.
Yeah. Wait a second, it's not that Diglo tequila stuff, huh?
you want this chilled? So
we did make a good margarita, though. I tell you that.
You're buying from the Southern rep and.
So I'm buying from the Southern rep. I can't remember his name, last name, Alan, his name. He's still around. I think he works for Majestic these days up in Boston or something. And, you know, he was a good guy. We got along great. He would constantly, you know, he would always be there, obviously, being a really good account for him. And just, you know, starting to talk to him and finding out what we did and or even seeing what he did. You know, he strolled in there at 2 o'clock. I don't think he ever answered the phone before 2. You know, I figured he was sleeping.
Yeah.
You know, and then 6 o'clock, he'd be at the bar having a drink.
So singing along to the Macarena.
Exactly. But I'm embellishing a little bit.
Yeah, now. He's probably not going to have a job when this comes out.
Yeah, he'll not have a job, exactly.
Thanks, Tommy.
But he was a good guy. He was real professional, and I really saw what that side of the business is and how. In a way, it fit my personality well as well. I mean, I couldn't sit at a desk 9 to 5.
Yeah.
We know that. I established that, you know, years earlier.
You weren't big on the college thing.
I wasn't big on the college thing. Definitely not. And I was determined to get out of Miami. I just had enough of it. And I'm a born and bred New Yorker, and I knew when I was coming back up to New York, I was, you know, no more restaurants.
Because you had grown up in Queens, and so you wanted to come back to the to the New York scene?
I grew up in Queens. Yeah, I mean, the only reason I left is because isn't that what you do? You got to leave once, right?
You got to leave once.
Come back after that.
But you were doing some skiing in Colorado too, like ski bump stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I left Colorado, I just packed up the car. I was ready to leave, going back to the girlfriend at the time. I was literally within a week of leaving. And she says, "You mind if I come with you? I just want to take a road trip, and then I'll come back after." It's, all right, sure. Yeah,
why this not? Is, she's leaving Queens to go with you to Colorado?
Yeah, essentially.
She's like, "I just want to take a road trip." And you're like, "Okay,
yeah, sure,
I'll move the skis over."
Yeah, no, she wasn't a skier. She's from, she's actually, I think she was actually a Miami girl. And we got out there, and I just wanted to go get out of New York and just kind of be a ski bum. It's where I kind of first got full-time into the restaurant business. I mean, I started bartending when I was 19. You know,
Did you take the course?
I took the course. I went to the bartender course.
A proud graduate.
A proud graduate. I made a killer screwdriver. You know,
you got all 8 ingredients of the screwdriver in there, did you? The ice, the glass, the orange juice,
said
the straw,
the stir stick, and an old fashioned as well. So I went through that, and actually, the reason I did that is I was I really just wanted to meet more people. I mean, I needed to make more money,
right?
I wanted to meet different people. You know, I was still in the neighborhood. I was like 19 or 20. I was still in the neighborhood. And, I just needed to get out. It's like, all right, I need to get out of these 5-square-block area here.
Right, same kids you went to school with.
So I went to bartending school, and they placed me in my first job out in Roslyn, Long Island, a place called the Jolly Fisherman.
Well, as long as the fisherman's happy, then you know it's a good thing.
It was real old school.
Like on the wharf kind of thing?
It wasn't even on the wharf. It was right in downtown Roslyn. You know, my co-bartender, I had two co-bartenders. One gentleman was about 7 years old. Stories to die for. You know, stories to die for. Bartended all around the world, professional one. And I ended up working there on and off for 6 years on Fridays and Saturdays. You know, left a little bit, came back, always had a gig, and then I stop working there, and then they call me. So listen, we need someone to fill in. So, you know, so that's how I got into it. So when I was heading out to Colorado, that's when I first got into, you know, full time in the restaurants, and I was just waiting tables, bartending, actually waiting tables over there mostly,
and skiing,
and that and wake it. I think we skied about 100 days that year. Woke up every morning. Got on the slopes like 8:30, 9 o'clock, skied right until 3 o'clock, had a locker right by the restaurant, threw all my gear in there, didn't even shower, and threw all my gear in there.
Which is something, a strategy that still works for you today, apparently.
It works very well. No one showers in this business. Come on. No. worked through the night, finished at about 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and then did the same thing again the next day.
So when you decided it was time to come back to New York, was that an easy transition? A lot of guys begging to give you a job?
Yeah, exactly. I was scared as all hell. I mean, I was first. You know, I mean, I was down in Miami. You know, you waste a lot of time down there. You guys like, all right, now what am I going to do? Am I going to do this all this? So I was determined to get into the restaurant side, and I had no idea how to do it. So I got back up here. I spoke to, I guess, a friend or two that were in the restaurant business. I knew about the beverage media, you know, a big useless book, and just literally flipped through every page. I think there was about 25 wholesalers in there at that time.
Not as many as today. Where
oh,
like
my God.
85.
No, 85? 200 wholesalers? Whatever. So I wrote up a resume. Faxed a resume when faxes were actually used.
It wasn't teletype?
It wasn't teletype. It wasn't Morse code either. Faxed a 25 or so, you know, including, you know, Skernick and whoever, Martin Scott, Weinbo, Wildman, whoever was around there. And one called. Paramount Eber Brothers.
One out of 25. Picked up the phone.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think the reason that they called is, besides not being very smart. No, I'm kidding. They hired me. I think they were relatively new in the market at that time. They were mostly an upstate company, a little more spirit-based at the time. And then they bought a wholesaler. Well, it was the Eber family, so they bought the wholesaler was named Paramount. And so they were, you know, within the market a couple of years, and they were expanding. They needed somebody to cover the outer territories. They needed Queens. I was a Queens native. I said, you know, it's got to be perfect for Queens.
Right. You spoke the language. You knew who
I spoke, yeah.
You knew who was out there, and, yeah. You know, you were a local kid.
Yeah, exactly. So I take the job. I have no idea what I'm doing. And they give me a book. They give me some samples. And, you know, I'm just running around to all corners of Queens. And back then, I mean, even today maybe, I could say this because I'm from Queens. Even Queens is a little backwards these days. It's not Brooklyn, that's for sure.
In terms of your farm-to-table restaurant so much.
Oh, God, I'm in a story. If I could have just a couple farm-to-table places in my neighborhood, I'd love that. So just running around Queens with a book that was, you know, we had a lot of spirits. And, you know, Queens was, you know, the spirit industry was pretty simple back then. But even back then, you know, we were selling Jim Beam. And even back then, Jim Beam, it's like I'd go into all these restaurants and I'd take out that bottle of Jim Beam and they'd point over to the back of the bar. You see that bottle of Jim Beam? It's been there for 10, 15 years.
Really? Just straight up Jim Beam?
Just straight up Jim Beam.
It was a difficult upsell.
It was a difficult sell, not even upsell. There wasn't anything really. Well, actually, I guess there was below it. And look at it today. I mean, what's in today? I mean, artisanal's in. You got all these local boutique distilleries on bourbons, rums, whatever. You know, and back then you couldn't even sell Beam. But they coddled me well. They did. They really gave me all the tools to do it. One of my managers, his name is Peter Sloan, and his. Couple things that I still remember today. He would basically tell me, if you're having a bad day, you're gonna have a lot of doors slammed in your face, you're having a bad day, go home, put your brain back together, and then tomorrow wake up, do it again. And he told me that constantly, and it was probably at that time, it was probably one of the best pieces of advice I ever got, even to this day.
Because there's a lot of rejection when you're a salesman at the wholesale level.
Oh, there's a ton of rejection. I mean, every day you get rejected. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, everybody's not going to buy what you're carrying around that day, obviously. You know, rejection is like, not right now. You know, maybe in the future it's like, oh, no, that's goddamn awful. Whatever.
But I mean, because a lot of times people are like, oh, wine salesman, that must be a cush gig. That must be great. You're hanging out with, you know, winemakers all the time. You're opening up fabulous bottles. But the part of the reality is you're taking a heavy bag around the subway all day and talking to guys who don't have enough time to talk to you or have other things on their mind.
Yeah, well, it's a hustle. I mean, how many times have you been sitting at the bar and you're tasting wine with your distributor, I'm tasting wine with the buyer. And then customer would be at the bar. It's like, wow, I want your job.
Right, right, right.
That's the greatest job in the world. You drink wine all day? It's like, yeah, that's all we do. Just drink wine all day. And then, you know, you just want to say to them, it's like, yeah, but you know, up and down a subway, you got six, you got nine bottles of wine in your bag. You know, either you're wheeling it behind you through the slush, or you got it on your shoulder and you go home at the end of the day, your back is killing you. You know, you got the August days and 95 degrees and bring you a bottle of wine and it's, you know.
At boiling
big,
temperature.
Fat Cabernet or Tannic Barolo. You got 95 degrees, like, that's good. You know, in the winter, you got your red wines at about 32 degrees, like a day like this.
little extra tannin coming through in the taste.
A little extra tannin. It does taste better cold than warm, though. That's for darn sure.
But when did you know that you wanted to be in the wine thing? Because it's not always, as we say, not always a fun thing to be traveling around the streets. But when did you say, like, hey, this is working for me? Was there a moment?
You know, I don't know if there was a moment, but I really wanted or needed this to succeed. I worked my butt off at Paramount, and it showed with the bosses over there. And within 6 months, they actually sent me on a wine trip.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't a wine trip that I earned. It was just, you know what, he's busting his butt. Let's send him somewhere. And it was definitely an eye-opening experience. It was a trip to France. First time I've ever been to France. And, you know, it's your typical death marches. You know, it was with Dan Kravitz.
Dan Kravitz, sure.
Selections, yeah. So, you know.
Hand-picked selections.
And it was your typical death march. And, you know, we'd be on the bus. We were in Bordeaux, we were in Burgundy, we were down south, we were in Provence, and we were in, Châteauneuf. And I guess my first real amazing experience was when we were down in Châteauneuf. We were, you know, we camped out at a hotel, we had a real nice dinner the night before, got to bed whenever we did after drinking all night. And me and this one other guy, didn't know, just met him on the trip, real nice guy. He was from Chicago, worked for a distributor over there. And we decided that we're going to wake up in the morning and just kind of explore. So one of the producers that Handpicked Selections was representing was Domaine Pigalle.
Oh, sure.
You know, great Châteauneuf producer. And we literally, if I remember correctly, I think we actually hopped into a cab. The hotel wasn't right, and we weren't right on the property. We hopped into the cab, took a cab ride out there. And got out of the cab. We were unannounced, and we knocked on the door. And we met her the day before. And Laurence, the daughter who's basically running it there now, she was so gracious, so friendly, and just took a good hour and a half of her time, and hopped in her pickup truck or her SUV. And just took us to all their vineyards the first time. You know, first time I really walked through the vineyards, and you know, as you know, Châteauneuf with the big guy stones, you know, beautiful. Took us through the cellars, the barrels. It was one of the most exhilarating experiences. The first one I had in this business, and I guess you could say I was kind of hooked that way, in that sense. So. And then after that, there's many more trips, and travel everywhere doing this. One of the key benefits of the trip, right? Australia, Chile, New Zealand, all over Europe.
Any other people on the trip really stand out for you on your way through wine's world?
Yeah, well, on these death marches, when you got people coming from all areas of the country, you don't know them. You get your good, you get your bad, you get your ugly. You get people you become friends with. People that it's like, oh man, they're just complaining all day long. But you always have cast of characters. Always someone getting in trouble. Either it's turning late, showing up to the bus late every day. Things like that. There was one guy. This is a short story. One guy who is a Texan, big loudmouth Texan. We were down in Chile. We went down there with Veramonte. And wake up in the morning, bus is ready to go. He doesn't show up for the bus. No one knows where he is. We were actually taking the bus to the airport. We were at Veramonte for one day, and they were taking us down to Patagonia for a week. Doesn't show up for the bus. Bus can't wait. You know, have to get going. Get on the plane. We get down there. He ends up getting himself down there after, but he apparently missed the bus because he couldn't find his wallet.
Oh yeah,
thought his wallet was lost. But the reason, which is not necessarily funny, but he thought it was stolen by the prostitute he hired the night before.
Right. Was he now in the Secret Service, or is that?
I don't know. God knows. It's Texas. You know, if, I think it turns out that the wallet was essentially under his bed.
Oh, so she wasn't like on a buying tour at Saks?
Exactly.
In Manhattan at that time?
No, Santiago.
So you were at Paramount. And yep. You're working with those guys, and you're selling wine, you're selling liquor, market's changing a little bit, and you had a friend over at Lobber.
Yep, I had a friend. Well, you know, I was at Paramount for about 9 years, mm-hmm. and it was a fantastic experience. I mean, when I joined them, they were small, and threw out there into the millennium, we were just on fire. I mean, Clico was a fraction of the size it was now. Moet ruled then. And, you know, so we really built up Clico to, you know, to be what is the most popular now, I guess.
I watched that rise.
You watched that rise. Yeah. Same here. I mean, I was selling just tons of it. Even then, it's a fraction of it's dropped since the millennium, you know, everything did in that sense. And, you know, kicked off Belvedere. Belvedere was just a pipe dream. They brought us, came into our sales meeting, bottles of Belvedere. I was still running around Queens at this time. And Belvedere was expensive.
It was like a luxury vodka.
It was a luxury. Yeah, it wasn't a $12 vodka. It was $25, $30. At that point, it was like $35. And I would actually have to take them. We couldn't sell Jim Beam in Queens. Imagine taking Belvedere.
Right.
Talk about that. Those doors getting shut on you. So it was a great rise, and I guess I cultivated my philosophies and my experience from there.
Were there special instances that really helped you develop who you were as a salesman that you maybe had with customers? Were there moments that really stood out?
You know, I was always told that this is it's not a sales gig, really.
Is that true?
I mean, to me, a sales gig is, you know, you're going door to door, you're selling vacuum cleaners. All right. You see the person, you don't know who they are. Yourself, you got to make that sale right there and then. You see them once, you never see them again. It doesn't matter what you sell them. It could, you know. With sales or the relationship side of it, we see each other all the time. Sometimes you might see a customer more than you see your wife. Mm-hmm. You know, you're working all day. So if I'm seeing a customer every month, let's say, some twice a month, some three times a month, in order for them to want to do business with you, yeah, you could have the products they want and they'll buy some. But in order to be truly successful with someone, you have to cultivate that relationship. And that relationship can come in so many different ways. You know, they have to at least like you, mm-hmm. or at least not hate you.
Because they got to be willing to take your calls.
They got to be willing to not even take your calls, but, know that you're not wasting their time. Mm-hmm. Know that you're bringing the right products to them. You know, it's cultivating that relationship from my standpoint is more of you really just need to sit back and listen. So, you know, you have many facets of the business. There's there's the sommelier trade, there's the local pub, there's the retail, there are places in between, and everyone is completely different. You know, for a retailer, you might throw out the scores. So you have to. A lot of them buy with them.
That's the language they talk.
You know, you're not going to, do that to a, four-star restaurant.
Because they'll get turned off. They'll be like, come on, dude.
Who cares? You know, you have to... And you have to, you have to ask the questions, really listen to and understand what they're trying to do at their restaurant. And that could come in, like I said, in many ways. You know, reading through the wine list and see what the wine list is. See what areas they're covering. Are they geared towards organic, biodynamic, natural? And as you taste with some and also getting to know their palate, which I think I do fairly well, understanding what their palate is and what they what generally pleases them and makes their eyes light up.
So the corner liquor store, the big shop retail, the more humble family restaurant, the big restaurant, what they all seem to have in common that works for you is that you go in and listen to them.
Yeah, you have to. You have to. There's too many salespeople that go out and listen. We all have quotas. We all have things to sell.
So somebody put something in your bag and like, hey, I want you to make some sales on this today.
Right. You know, it's the whole bit. I mean, a lot of the business is a quota-driven business.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
if you sell 10,000 cases, we'll take you on this trip, that kind of stuff.
Take you on the trip. And, you know, even from a company standpoint, you got to be profitable. Just like a restaurant. You know, you don't want to, you know, you don't want something to sit there forever.
Mm-hmm. You got to turn over
inventory. You got to sell it and turn it over. So it's really on every aspect of it. But it doesn't suit anybody if you're just focusing on what you're being told to sell.
Got it.
You have to focus on what will sell or what they want.
Because I've noticed with you, one of the things you do is when you're waiting for an appointment is you'll flip through the wine list, as opposed to, you know, it seems like you want to learn what a place is about.
You have to, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You have to.
Because there's a lot of time people are just waiting, you know, at a bar for the buyer to show up, or because I'm always running late,
have
or
their espresso.
Right, right.
Well, when we first met, you know, you were at Alto, and I must say, I don't think at that point Verity had the most dynamic Italian portfolio, and that's what you were buying.
Well, it's developed a little bit, though.
It's totally completely developed, but we got to know each other in a short period of time, and I would think that it's the way I handled you, and the way everything I am bringing you, really thinking about what's in my book. And it's like, oh, would he like that? Would he like that? Would he like that? No, that's not going to work. That's not going
to
work.
Because a lot of times the buyer just doesn't have the time to sort through the book. So you kind of help them do that in a way.
The buyer doesn't have the time to sort through the book at all.
Yeah.
You know, you could ask the questions like, hey, what are you looking for?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some people might have clear thing in mind. Some people not. I mean, you know, you probably took the appointments. Like, all right, this guy's trying. You know, let me come in and make the appointment. But ultimately, it's really seeing, you know, what I need to bring. No one has time to look through a book. You're inundated with, like, there's 200 wholesalers out there, and then you got managers, and you got their managers, and you got importers, and all these people. So who has time? You have, I mean, how many people you got knocking on your door on a daily basis? 20 people every day? So you don't have time to, and then you get 200 emails, and you know, you don't have time to look through a book. So I need to make sure that I'm not wasting your time. And by, you know, all the things we mentioned and bringing the right things. You know, one of the hardest things is proper email etiquette in this new day and age, since there's so many people running around every day. I mean, I probably don't get a lot of emails, comparatively speaking. I might get 75 a day, but you know, you got to weed through them. So someone like you probably get about 500. And proper email etiquette is probably, I think, is one of the hardest things to do, because you need to convey a message, number one, but you got to find a fine line. Are you sending too many emails, too many useless emails, or are you sending not enough where you're not even relevant? If you send too many, then you're going to see my name pop up. It's like, delete that.
Automatic delete.
Delete that. Dun, dun. You know, so that's one of the hardest things in, you know, figuring out what to send you.
Am I bugging you too much? Am I bugging you not enough?
Right. And you have to, and you send pertinent stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, so even with, I mean, one thing I always send at the beginning of the month, I always send my price book
mm-hmm.
to people, to all my customers. You know, that's pertinent. And it keeps them, even former customers, you know, just to keep like, hey, you know, I'm still around, whatever, you know, you look at it, not, then you can delete it. But, you know, essentially it one day gets to be, you know, important again down the line when people move around. And, you know, it's, again, relationships. So that relationship will always do full circle and come back to you, even if it disappears for a little while.
So you feel like that buyers do tend to move around, and what you really end up doing is making a connection with the person, not the venue so much, because they'll move and maybe there'll be less sales at that place in that wake, but they'll go somewhere else and you'll do well there.
Yeah, it could work out both ways. Mm-hmm. You know, if a buyer leaves a restaurant, depending on who's coming in, you know, your business can go from, you know, real great to virtually nothing, depending on who they know and everything. But the most important thing is when the buyer does leave, we all know people, it's a circle. It's not a big business. It's real small. And keeping those contacts are the most important thing. And that buyer will go from place to place to place to place. And you gotta keep that going.
What are some of the buyer encounters that have really stood out for you over your career?
Buyer encounters, you know, they're all kind of different. There are some buyers where you just become friends with, and you get to know, and you end up over at their house, and they end up over at your house, and things like that. The buyer thing is, it's pretty. I did tell one customer to screw off once, though.
I forgave you for that.
No, it wasn't you. No, it was this police down in East Village. I remember doing that, and it's like, oh my God, I couldn't stand him. He was actually the owner, not even the buyer. And, I got home. I left the restaurant. First thing I did, I was called my boss at Paramount. It's like, I think I screwed up today.
Yeah. He's like, okay, like, go home.
Oh, what'd you do? It's like, told a customer to F off.
It's like,
probably not a good thing to do. It's like, you want me to take you off the account? Probably be a good thing.
Yeah. So do you sometimes kind of self-regulate in that way? Like, hey, I don't think this relationship's going so well. Maybe this account would be better with somebody else in the company, different personality, and maybe I'll switch out with them on something that they're not doing too great at?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that a regular? Do you guys have those discussions? Because it seems things just kind of happen, and you're like, wow, that's weird. No, there's a new guy here. So do you have like regular meetings where you're like, hey, are you getting along with this guy? I mean, what are those meetings like?
Oh, well, absolutely. Well, first of all, if a buyer changes, the new buyer might have a relationship with another salesperson.
So do you all sit down and you're like, who knows Joe? And then like a guy raises his hand and you're like, okay, why don't you go talk to him? Kind of thing?
It doesn't quite happen that way. It's more like coworker call, but it's like, hey, Tommy, it's like, I got a buyer. He just went over to one of your restaurants. He really wants to work with me. You know, can we do something? So, if it's a good customer, you did really well there. You want to trade something out. If it's a mediocre customer, and if it's a mediocre customer or a poor customer that you really didn't do much business with, yeah, just take it, see what you can do with it. I have a much different perspective on that these days now that with Verity and investing in it. I definitely, even though my investment is quite paltry, I do look at it a different way.
Because like, you want the bottom line to come
out. Got to be profitable, got to get the money back someday, right? And, so I'll look at an account or someone will, another salesperson come up to me and it's like, okay, so how am I doing there? It's like, could someone do better? So I'll definitely look at it from different glasses now. And even look at my account, I'm not doing good with this, not doing good with this. Usually you trade out, once a year, beginning of the year, you've just finished a year, you just had a banner year, everything was great. And then you sit down for your reviews.
Crunch the numbers.
And it's like, listen, you're doing great with these here. It's like, why aren't you doing good with that? Why aren't you doing good with this account? And, let's weed out. Generally, most salespeople probably have way too many accounts.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Even with the number of importers and distributors and salesmen in the ground, you think that in general people are given a little too much to cover?
Yeah, because, there's a lot of restaurants
and
retail stores out there. And, Verity has... how many, 35 salespeople?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is a lot.
Which is a fair amount. Out of that 35, I guess 25 are based in the boroughs here. And, 25 people for, 10,000 licenses. I mean, that's a lot of room to cover.
Do you feel like you can go through a whole career and not even really touch certain market segments? Just like, hey, yeah, I never sold to a Mexican restaurant kind of place, or I never sold to the Greek places, or do you feel like you can go the whole way through and just never really get involved with certain segments?
Absolutely. Well, it depends on what you're selling.
Yeah.
You know, would I knock on the door of a Mexican restaurant? No, probably not. I mean, how much wine does a Mexican restaurant sell? Not much for the most part. You know, being a wine house, you know, we're not strong in the Mexican restaurant or even the pub market theoretically. But you know what? One thing salespeople do wrong is they pigeonhole themselves into a demographic.
Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely salespeople that love handling the 4-star restaurants, the sommelier trade, love doing that. There's some salespeople that you know, much more retail oriented, less on premise. One thing I learned from day one, which I still religiously do, is I kind of try to segment my account run into portions. You know, I want to have a portion of, you know, the somm trade. I want to have portion retail. And retail is where the money is, no matter what anybody says.
Is that true? So the glamour is on the restaurant side. But
the glamour is on the restaurant side. And how many times have I heard that's like, you know, yeah, we want to build this brand into an icon in restaurants. And we don't care about retail until they need the depletions.
Mm-hmm. Until then, like, how come nothing's moving?
Exactly. And then you need the depletions. And, you know, that's when it's, you know, that's when the retail comes in. But it's, you know, so I segmented, you know, the somm trade, the retail, mid-tier restaurants, B restaurants. And part of my success is I actually have a really good network of pubs that I do great business with.
Because maybe they don't have a lot of wine, but what they have, they move?
What they don't, well, A, obviously they need to be busy. If they're busy, they don't have a lot of wine. The wine list is really small. And in those kind of places, when you develop a relationship, it's pretty much all yours if you have that close of a relationship.
Because there's not a lot of people who are – that's not on their radar a lot.
It's not on the radar. You know, the big companies, Empire and Southern, they'll go after everything. But, you know, there's a lot of places that, you know, no, I'll just buy booze from them and find wine from others. So, I mean, I probably have about 20 pubs that I do business with. And we're going back 12, 13 years.
Because some of those buyers probably stay there for a long time. Like whoever is the buyer at a pub probably isn't moving to some other.
Yeah, well, there you deal mostly with the a lot with the owners.
The owner,
you know. I mean, a good friend of mine, Noelle. She works. She's one of the partners over at Stout over by Madison Square Garden. I think everybody's probably been there when they have gone to the garden. It's a huge, big beer bar. They have 30, 40, 50 stouts. You know, the place is a monster, and it's busy as all heck. You know, but, you know, I used to work with her, actually. She used to work at Paramount with me. And her owner, well, she's one of the owners, but her partner, you know, he owns like 8 other pubs. So, and this is a relationship that was cultivated 10 plus years ago that is still going strong and still one of my most important people, because you put those 10 together, you now have, you know, a good chunk of business right there.
So a lot of times we think about the 3- and 4-star restaurants as like making wines, but in terms of actual what actually moves through the market, something that just does tons of volume and has multiple outlets can really help you out.
I think every business has to have, the philosophy of Verity was, you know, we want to kind of be there for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And
is that a hedge against different kinds of economy? Like, hey, luxury is doing really well now. Oh, also, you know, this kind of thing is doing well now. Now that the economy is not so good, that kind of allows you to carry through different sorts of years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's the first thing that stops selling if the economy tanks? You know, your premium bottles. And I think when Verity started in 2009, you know, that was the crash. You know, that's when the banking crash was. And a lot of the small companies that were out there at that point that only sold expensive wines, they were really struggling. Yeah, you know,
because it had been a strong niche before. They'd built all the way around it, and then
it was really strong. And that's how they built their model on that. When Verity started, the business plan was modeled on a down economy. I mean, it was 8 months after the economy crashed, I guess, something like that. And so it was modeled after a down economy, and which is, okay, you know, people, it's like, is this a good time to start a company? And me, I got wind of it in August of 2009 when the four managing partners, they started hatching the plan in December, January. Some of them saying, well, when did the banks crash? I think it was November, so a couple months after. And, you know, they were putting together a business plan. And then I got wind of it, and people would ask me, my parents said, is this the time to join a new company? I mean, the economy stinks. And yeah, you could look at it that way. It's like, yeah, okay. But is it better to put a business model together on a down economy where you could ride the wave when it goes up? Or is it better to start it when things are good, and then if it crashes, your numbers are completely out of balance, right?
And also, you're probably not sitting on a lot of stock right away that you have to move, that you maybe bought at higher prices because you're starting after the crash and prices are lower.
Well, what we did at the beginning with Verity, we're starting to get into the direct import stuff now. But what we did at Verity at the beginning is we didn't direct import anything, which was another fantastic idea, which really helped our success. We worked specifically through importers or brokers.
So you're not sitting on stock of your own. That
if we needed to order 7 cases of something, you know, we'd order 7 cases. You know, when you're direct importing, you know, you got to take a pallet, you got to fill a container, you got to do all. So it's like, okay, that container comes here, and all of a sudden, it's not selling. It's like, oh damn, now what do we do? But with working with importers, where a lot of them warehoused in Jersey, they're at Fond du Lac where we are, or Western, you know, just a short transfer away, in 3 days you have inventory. But if we needed to buy 7 cases of wine X, we'd buy 7. If we needed to buy a pallet, 56 cases, we'd buy a pallet, or and so on. So that really helped our, because we didn't raise a lot of capital at the beginning.
But it's a fairly big company for which you didn't raise a lot of, I mean, 35 salesmen is pretty big.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? By virtue of distribution. So it seems like you started out what I guess it would be a medium biggish company on a relatively modest financial model.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I guess even when we started, I guess we weren't small, and we didn't just have 2 pages. You know, we actually had a book, and that book was put together by long-term relationships. I would definitely say it's from the beginning. The model that was put down worked to a T.
Mm-hmm.
You know, besides the direct import, not doing direct imports, the four managing partners knew that they needed to get out of the gates really quick. So okay, so how do you put together a sales force? Okay, you can hire rookies, you know, no relationships. You know, have to teach them, you know, you're off to a slow start. And if you want to make an impact, you know, you need to do it quickly. You only really have one chance to do it for the most part. So not having a lot of money, and really needing to think of how do we get veterans to come to us
without offering them a huge salary.
You know, I mean, you know, they offered a nice compensation, but you know, that goes away in a year. And after that, it's like, uh-oh, now what do I do? So they started the company as an employee-owned company.
And so that gave you an incentive to move because you had equity.
It definitely was a big portion. When I was at Lauber, and I wasn't unhappy. I wasn't necessarily unhappy. I remember when the plan for Verity was hatched, I guess Steve Duran and Chris DeZora were the first to really start talking about it. I think that's how it worked. Chris was one of our suppliers. He worked for Dender Wine Management, which was the first people that actually brought their products over to us for about 6 months. Anyway, you know, we were close friends for 6 months. It's like, got a plan. Got a business going to start. It's going to be great. You're going to love it. It's like, you're going to come join us. And I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. You know, so after, and then he kept on doing that. It's like, you can't afford me. you can't afford me. It's like, don't worry, you'll see. And so let's see, I think they started hatching the plan in December, like I said, and it happened for me, it happened really, really quick. And then I guess sometime in the summer of 09, July or August, the plan started to evolve, and I knew Chris was involved. I knew Steve was involved, and they mentioned that Bill Shambi was involved. It's like, really? Bill Shambi was with, I think most people know him out there. He was with Lauber for 25, 30 years. He was there for a salesperson. And I guess, you know, and one of the top people there. I was like, Bill, really? And I was thinking, I was like, all right, this is kind of intriguing. I'll bite. I'll listen to what you have to say. And from there, it happened really, really quick. I mean, I think it was mid-August. Met them at the fourth partner, Connie Ulmer, who is our chief financial officer. Met them at her apartment and listened to what they had to say. And I was impressed with a few things. A, with Connie, who is instrumental in our success. I think one of the other things that's a lot of wholesalers and small wholesalers don't have is we had a outside the wine business financial mind that was part of the four managing partners.
Got it. So it's not a bunch of poetic wine guys being like, well, we can make this happen.
A couple of us.
But it was, there was also this mind being like, hey, there's a number here that we need to meet.
Exactly. Exactly. And there needs to be checks and balances, and it's a company. We need to make money. The books need to balance. Actually, the other thing, and I'm really not sure why I thought about this, but right off the bat, I was looking at the four partners, and I knew three of them. Connie was the only one I didn't know. And I'm thinking, it's like, you know, I was taking the subway home after a meeting with them, and I was thinking about the four personalities. Connie's got a pretty big personality, so you know her personality right away. But they all brought different things to the table. You know, Bill was the voice of reason. Connie was the energetic. Chris was more fly by the seat of his pants. Steve was a little more analytical. You know, so I thought that, oh, you know, the four of them, they kind of complement each other, and one would put the other in, you know, put them in their place, or not really that way, but you know, just you know, it's like, well, we could do it this way, you know, and then the discussion happens.
What was the reality of putting together a fairly largest book in an area where there are a lot of small niche importers? And what was the focus? Because it doesn't seem like you guys went in any one direction. You didn't say like, hey, we're all about organic wine, or we're all about German wine. You kind of spread it out. Was it hard to put together that large of a portfolio in an era where there's so much competition from importers, or how did you go about it?
Well, I think besides the economy being, you know, bad, and the business model in that bad economy, another thing that was in our favor was that because the economy was so bad, every single winery out there was unhappy. You know, everybody's sales was down.
Everybody wanted to do more volume.
And everybody wanted to do more volume, which is not, you know, theoretically the reason to move. I mean, okay, the economy's down, so what are you going to do? It's like, you know, we got to wait for it to come back up. But, you know, not everybody thinks that way. So there were so many people looking to at least have a conversation of, you know, it's like, well, I'll, you know, listen. And a lot of it worked out. And of course, others didn't, but a lot of it worked out. But when we, you know, I think it's important to, we wanted to build a company that was, you know, for every man, not just for one segment of the trade. You know, the retail items are the more volume items. You need those. I mean, those are the ones that keep the lights on all the time. Mm-hmm. And you know, you need to have those and sell and things that are consistent inventory. You need the fine Burgundies, which, you know, you're here today, they're gone tomorrow. There, you know, there's not a lot of volume there.
Because that gets the high-end sommeliers on the phone.
You get the high-end sommeliers on the phone. As a, you know, we like the organics and biodynamics just as wine people and what it brings us and what we like. I think, you know, but we definitely, I think one thing we definitely try to stay away from, we definitely try to stay away from the overly ripe, big, fat things, you know, things that have a little more heart and soul to it. And that's definitely where it, you know, where it started at the beginning. But as, you know, knowing we wanted to grow into a larger wine company, you know, we needed to bring in, you know, a good diverse portfolio.
And one of the things that's changed somewhat recently, is that you added Vineyard Brands to the lineup. What was that change like, and what did that bring to Verity?
It was, it was probably a little scary. It's like Vineyard Brands, wow, that's big.
That's, I mean, there's a lot in that book.
And there's a lot in that book, and it was big, and it's like, oh, could we actually didn't take them on right away. I think we probably held them off. It's like, listen, you know, it's just too soon. And then eventually, it was time is right, or it's like, oh, we need to make this work and get it together. But that definitely catapulted us into the next stratosphere. I mean, it's like you said, it's a big portfolio. There's a lot of brands there.
Bucastel, and
you know, in that it's Feinbach. Actually a portfolio that works perfect for the model of, you know, wine company for everybody, because, you know, you had your Bucastels and you had your Burgundies and Weinbachs, but you also had your Marqués de Cáceres,
mm-hmm. which is a big retail item,
which is important. You know, same thing when we took on, I guess a year earlier, Eric Solomon Selections. Again, it was, at that point, it was a big portfolio for us at that, because that was within a year and a half. And again, it's very well respected on the top end, but also with inexpensive or retail item like a Vodia, which you, blue label you see in every, we hope in every retail store.
But your career did take you on an interesting path, because you worked for Paramount and then for several years, and then Southern Internet Market, and purchased Lauber, mm-hmm. and then you moved to Lauber. What was that change like?
Well, when I was when Southern came into the market, I guess 8-9 years ago, you know, I was at Paramount then for you know 7 or so years. And, you know, when they came to the market, and when Charmer and Peerless merged, essentially, the market completely changed.
What was the difference before and after?
Well, for us at Paramount, we lost a ton of brands. And we lost Belvedere, we lost Clicquot, we lost Stimson Lane at that time. We lost a lot of our brands. So
why do you think they moved?
You know, corporate alliances, you know, throughout the country.
So you're saying that because something was a tight relationship in a different market, maybe Vegas, they wanted to maintain that relationship there, and so they moved in the New York market?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, Southern's the biggest in the, you know, in the country. So, and they obviously have alliances. I mean, I don't know how many states they're in, but, you know, they were never in New York before. So you take a, you know, group like Stimson Lane, which is, you know, Chateau Saint Michel people, and that you know, I was like, boom, they were gone. You know, the Clicquot thing was more Clicquot Inc. was separate from LVMH from OA Hennessy at that time, and that company merged, so that was a different reason. But you know, we found ourselves losing all these brands, and I'm like, oh man, okay, this is getting a little scary. But throughout the whole time, in a way, I was real loyal. You know, it's like, oh, no, it's going to get better. I talked to my wife. It's like she would tell me, you got to go. But, you know, during the whole time, you know, I always, another thing that's really important from a salesman's way, be friends with everybody. Know all the salespeople from different companies that are out on the street. Be friends with them. Treat them with respect. Get to know them. You know, just let that be your internal network. So one of the guys that I knew well was Bill Bendelow, who works for us now. And I would, you know, probably talk to him for about a year. It's like, hey, you know, of any openings there? You know, of any openings? And it's like, no, nothing now. You know, send your resume to this person, but I don't know of anything. And then one day I got a phone call from him. And he literally told me, it's like, send your resume now. It's like, okay. So
there was an opening, territory.
It was an opening of a territory and a real territory. It's like, oh, wow. Okay, that works. So
how does having one territory or another affect your life? I mean, what are the basics of that for someone who may not know?
Well, the general start if you're not in the business prior to is you get thrown to you the riffraff. You get the small accounts that everybody throws back into a pile.
Like in Glengarry Glen Ross when he's calling that guy for the fifth time.
Exactly.
Like, I know someone called you last week. We wanted to check in again, see if maybe you want to buy some property with us.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, yeah, it's like, I never did anything with him. Throw it back in a pond. The next person takes it, and it's like, I never did anything. So you throw it. So they put together, everybody does this. They put together an account run of 50, 75 accounts of, you know, people that are constantly on COD, things like that.
Right.
So, you know, that's generally how it starts for someone that's new into the market. But if you're a veteran and you have, you hopefully do the right thing and people like you and you switch jobs, I mean, you're looking to switch jobs into a territory. So a key territory had to open up.
And that would be like Manhattan, Brooklyn.
Yeah, depending on where. I mean, the territory that opened up for me in Lauber, unfortunately, salesperson passed away.
Huh. It's like, you know, happened.
You know, yeah. And, you know, so it's like, oh, great. Territory. All right. And the other thing, and it was a territory that fit Lauber's book really, really well. You know, it was steakhouse driven.
Oh, okay.
Lauber had all the, the big steakhouse brands, whether it's Phelps, Jordan, so on. And it felt very, and I also looked at it, and it was, to me, it was truly underperforming. I was like, this is all this territory did with these accounts? It's like, no way. And I interviewed with them three times, I think. It was a slam dunk. They wanted me. They offered me the job. Everything was done. And then I had to make my decision. And it was a no-brainer decision. But even though it was a no-brainer decision, it took me weeks and weeks to decide to go. It's like everything was pointing at it. It's like Paramount was losing brands left and right. My income was dropping, you know.
Because your income's based on sales commission.
It's commission. So, yeah,
if you're not moving those brands, you're not making any money.
Exactly. And everything was clear. My wife said, you got to do this. It took me 6 weeks to finally decide. It was mostly out of loyalty. It's like, I got my start here. They treated me so well. They were great to me. They gave me everything I needed to do. Took me 6 weeks, and then I finally decided to do it.
But I heard from several people that with the ending of Paramount, they were kind of saying, hey, we're going to pull this back around, kind of right up until it ended. So you didn't know it was going to...
Well, that was the spin. Yeah. I mean, you know, a company's not going to, you know, come out and tell us like, oh, we're not going to make it. You know?
Yeah, right.
It's like, oh, no, a year, we're going to be gone in a year. You know, Paramount, you know, they went into a partnership with National, which is another big wholesaler in the country, you know, that dissolved. And it was clear. It's like, oh no, we're not. But even though it was dying, they said it's not going anywhere. It's like we're doing fine, you know. And then all of a sudden I take the job at Lauber in it seems like I start jobs and finish jobs on September 1st for my last three gigs. It's kind of weird. 6 months after I joined Lauber, I get phone calls from all my friends who are working at Paramount. They're shutting the company. They sold it to Southern. They're shutting the company. It's like everybody's got to re-interview for jobs. I mean, I am. It's probably the most fortunate thing that ever has happened to me in this business. It wasn't because I was smarter. Dumb luck, I think. Because, yeah, I mean, we all saw it, but it was, you know, complete denial. So 6 months, so everybody is literally
looking for jobs in a tight market.
You're talking about 150 salespeople looking for jobs in New York State.
On the same day.
on the same exact day. And a bunch of them joined Lolliver, but they kind of went everywhere.
And they didn't get the pick of the litter territory like you did.
And that's the other thing. A couple people really just seemed like they never kind of reemerged. A sense, the funny thing is, maybe not the very intelligent thing is, I should have made the decision to go to Lolliver immediately. But when I was posed with this decision to go with Verity, both decisions were made when my wife was in Canada. She was back home visiting her family. And I called her up. I got home. I don't even think I waited till I get home. I called her up. I want to do this. And she was like, what? What do you mean you want to do this? It's like, this is a new company. When you left Paramount, it took you 6 weeks. You're deciding in a day? It's like, yeah. I mean, get home. We'll talk about it more. But yeah, I'll tell you why. And time, it needed to be done then too, because, this was mid-August. And Verity was basically up and running a month later.
It was a quick move. I mean, in terms of Verity's rise, it was kind of rumored about, and then boom, they had a big and fairly large-ish presence all of a sudden.
I mean, for me, it was the process was 1 month. I mean, finding out about it, sitting, saying yes, and then it starting up.
What was the Lolliver experience like, though, in between? How did that affect your life? I mean, what was the reality of working at Lolliver?
The Lolliver experience was, for the most part, fantastic. The Lolliver organization was, when I started there, was just the hands-down greatest place to be. I mean, they were buttoned up. It was run like a fine oil machine. The first thing that blew me away, and this seems so small and insignificant. I come home one day and there's a box at my doorstep, and in that box, I had no idea what it was. We weren't expecting anything. Stack of sales catalogs, for the month. It's like, oh my God, no way.
They're setting you up.
They're setting me up. Paramount, I think we got our sales catalogs a week late every month, so it's like, oh man, this is great.
Somebody wants me to succeed here.
I don't have to run to the office and waste a day and pick up catalogs.
Do you think that the liquor business has changed to just be a little bit more crossing the T's and dotting the I's in, say, the last 20 years as things have gotten so much more competitive in the New York market?
I think it's gotten more competitive in New York market because there are just a lot more people running around.
Yeah.
Than anything. I mean, the big spirit houses have grown to be so big, and everything has merged where they're just so large now. And a lot of it is corporate. Corporate needs to answer to different people,
shareholders,
not just. And it's a matter of, it's about selling and making that number every single year, and hook or by crook, you got to do it in that world.
It's a little less casual, like, oh yeah, I haven't heard from him. I don't know when he showed up today. It's more like there's a guy who's calling you, like, what's going on?
Yeah, three of them.
So, what do you see Verity progressing in the next few years? You got Vineyard Brands now. You're doing Eric Solomon. What's going to happen in the next 5-10 years with Verity in the New York market?
Right now it's status quo in the sense that we're a decent size, we're doing well, we're moving forward. We got a lot on our plate, and this year it's a matter of getting all our, making sure everybody's happy, making sure that the brand's going out there. So, nothing's coming to us. We're not looking at anything to move us forward in that sense. Just, organic growth.
We want to utilize what you have.
Yeah, which is going phenomenally well. And I think the other thing that's the way we'll branch out is now more direct import stuff.
Mm-hmm. Bringing stuff for yourself.
Bringing stuff for ourselves, which benefits everybody.
Because you can offer it for a lesser price because you're cutting out.
You cut out the middleman.
Yeah.
So as a direct import, you cut out the middleman. And, we can order more wine now than we could at the beginning
because the float's a little bit bigger.
Yeah, even though we monitor that really closely, but that's the next step in the evolution. And we started to direct import some Italian wines and actually some Greek wines. That's because of a friend of Christos Oras. And we're taking those. He's working on taking those wines to a few different markets. New York, New Jersey, Chicago, or Illinois, Delaware area. So which is also good because that gives us avenue and inventory, which is being spread out. But it's also here for us. So inventory be consistent.
Tommy Vanek, thank you for breaking down the nuts and bolts. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. It was a great experience.
Tom Vanek of Verity Wines. Thank you for being on the show today.
Take care.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Skella has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's alldrinktothatpod.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.